Welcome to D&D, the Dinner Party Role Playing Podcast. I'm your host and Dungeon Master James Russell. With me today are the fun people. Say hi, fun people.
Hi.
We are back for part two of our end of season five discussion. You guys sent in a bunch of really great questions, and we didn't get to many of them.
Russell was like, guys, we didn't talk about the season at all. We have to do it again.
We did more than it seemed when we finished, which we talked about that in the discussion about how we always finish and are like, oh, that's not what we thought it was going to be, but then it's fine. And that's exactly what happened. We did talk a little bit about the season, but we did not talk much about the season, and you guys did have some questions. So we will get back, we will get into that, and we'll, answer some of those. We'll talk a little bit more about the show and stuff, and then just looking ahead at the schedule, next week will probably be a Tim story, and then potentially a couple of those, and then it will be February, in the month of February, before we get into season six proper. And we had mentioned last time that we'll do like a session zero kind of character based discussion, internal discussion episode, before we start the season proper, to update, you know, character sheets and get everybody kind of ready to play again as we head into the new series. No spoilers, obviously, but I thought of something last night that I'm very, very excited about. I was telling Erica about it this morning at breakfast, and it is, I was very, very pleased with myself for this idea, and I'm excited to, and it's going to be like right at the beginning. So I'm pumped to
cool
for you guys to experience that. Let's just get into questions, right away. Since we did the preamble and shit last time, no more Baldur's Gate talk this time. unless you guys started playing, but I don't think you did. So,
I did. I do have something to contribute about Baldur's Gate real quick. It was a really funny Reddit post about a girl who took a video of her boyfriend creating a character, and then she like turned the camera towards herself, and it looks exactly like her. But apparently, that character ends up turning in. Never mind, spoilers. But I think I know
what you're gonna say.
Yeah, apparently it's gonna be really funny later yes. on. So I laughed yes. at the not knowing, because I didn't know, and I guess he didn't know, but she knew.
So that is very funny.
So don't make characters that look like people you know are significant others, because things can happen.
Mm-hmm. I want to know, but I'm gonna play the game, so I don't want to know.
Wait till it goes on sale.
I had a friend last night be like, hey, will you play the game with me? And I was like, yes. And they were like, okay, well, I already played the game as a good person, so if you play it with me, we have to do an evil run.
No, don't do that.
You're okay. Bad at being bad.
Unless you want to.
If I'm going to do an evil run, I have to do it first, because apparently if you do a good run, you make friends with everybody, and so you don't want to do the evil run because you do bad stuff to them in the evil run.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You can do some truly despicable shit. I don't know if I would be able to do.
Portal hand, and you can cut it off instead of grabbing it.
We're talking about Baldur's Gate again, damn it.
Anyway, questions. Back to.
No, we're gonna. All right, let's do a question. So this is from Matt Reese. Matt says, "I have two questions. One for you, Gressel, and one for the players. Mostly for James and Chelsea. First question." When did the idea occur to have spaghetti clowns as the emissaries for Digidon? Was it during the first creation of it, at the beginning of this season, or during it? Second question. If Jason, Freddy, Michael, Leatherface, Chucky, and Leprechaun, and Art the Clown, and Valak the Demon Nun, were sent to a D&D world, what classes would they be? Well, that seems pretty clear. Some are magic and some are not.
I mean, obviously, Valak's a paladin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or
is Leprechaun or a
cleric? Yeah, or cleric.
Oh.
Yeah.
Leprechaun would be a wizard or a sorcerer. I mean, Leprechaun would just be a warlock, I think.
Oh.
Chucky would be a warlock. Chucky has a patron.
He wouldn't be an assassin, like a rogue.
No, Chucky has a Yeah, Chucky has a patron. Chucky is a warlock if ever there was one. Yeah,
Dumbala.
Dumbala.
Freddy, what's the
I need
tank?
To like look up the D&D classes.
Yeah.
Barbarian, one of them. What's that?
Yeah, I think Jason, Michael, and Leatherface are kind of all flavors of barbarian.
Yeah, they're all like just big guys.
I think Michael Myers subclass into monk because he doesn't really speak. So
that's true.
He's very like
Leatherface could be surprised druid.
I could see Leatherface could as a see druid. That, sure, he's got yeah. kind of a connection to nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
were there others? Art the Clown?
Art the Clown.
I mean, he's a bard.
Bard, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Bard.
Perfect. The Spaghetti Clowns. When did that come up? That was not initially part of the Spaghetti Clown lore when Spaghetti Clown first came about. But I forget why. But when we were getting close to those sessions, when we were doing the James Bond snow sequence, and we were getting close to the cave, and I knew that we were going to get into the cave. I was kind of Flack was currently the Spaghetti Clown. I was like, okay, we got to do something with this. And somehow it came up like, what is the origin of Spaghetti Clown, or like, why is Spaghetti Clown even a thing? Like, why are these posters in general? And I was reading about the origins of the Spaghetti Clown.
In real life.
Yeah. And I forget exactly the terms for it because it's Italian. But that character is from like old Italian.
Oh, yeah.
It'd
be like a Perel clown, I think.
Yeah. I forget what it's called.
Yeah. There's like a few stock types of clowns from like old Italian. Like theater and I think there's some crossover with Gran Guignol theater, which is kind of like, how would you just describe Gran Guignol, James? Because that's kind of like a horror thing, also.
Yeah, that's like live performances that relish in the shocking and graphic on stage. Big horror predecessor, theatrical, right?
Yeah.
It's French.
Because you'd have the Pierrot clown, you would have the a Harlequin and that's like Punch and Judy kind of mm-hmm. come from that too. It's like it's character archetypes. And the Pierrot clown was always, I think, like the sad clown. Like kind of more like melancholy.
It's David Bowie in Ashes to Ashes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yes, there were these like theater origins of the clown, which is cool for Flack being a bard and everything too. There was this idea of the clown, these like very archetypal, they represent these broad swaths of types of characters and things. So that's why I thought it would be kind of fun to use them as these like stock nameless entities, you know, within this world of where like, you know, you know spirits kind of lose their individuality and whatever. So that was kind of the decision behind making them part of like the Digidon world. And I also, you know, the noodles thing kind of got me thinking of like, oh yeah, if we have these, if the Aurora are kind of pathways or rivers or, you know, roads, however you want to look at it, you know, if you just put a roof on those, they become tubes and spaghetti and, you know, noodles and tubes and it all the jokes that we made when we were in it. It's not the best, you know, the clearest connection, but the bigger thing is that kind of theater origin of them being these like everyman stock representations for you know, just types of people. Thanks, Matt. And I'm glad that we were able to decide that Leatherface could have some bard elements.
Or no, druid.
Druid yeah. elements, yeah. right.
Sorry. Leatherface is not a bard.
No. That'd be adorable, though.
Beautiful singing voice.
That'd be so cute.
Like social skills and charisma.
Aw, it'd be so sweet. Myself.
Chop Top would be a bard. Music
Chop
is
Top
his
would
life.
Be a bard. There you go. Yeah, music is his life. I mean, that's like the bard mantra.
Okay, I am going to tweak a question of Lindsay Newton's. So Lindsay asked if you could make any dice roll fail instead of succeed or vice versa, what would it be? And I think that she's asking for like a specific roll, which is a little bit too like specific of a question, because any one roll, you know, could obviously have a lot of ripple effects and everything. But I'm going to tweak that question because I think it would be an interesting discussion to say, if you could have any role always fail or always succeed, which role would you want to always work or not work? Obviously, you know, always not working is a different thing, but like, could it be fun if something always failed or intimidate? You would always want intimidation to succeed?
To fail. No.
To fail.
Yeah.
Oh. Why?
I'm just bad at intimidating. Like just in real life, and I don't even think I could do it in a role play situation.
Like you're 6'3".
Yeah,
but for whatever reason, like I go to our local grocery store and I'm like, I just need salmon, right? I just need fish. And the guy's like, hey, how's your day going? And I'm like, all right, it's going all right. How about you? And he just goes, I gotta find a better lawyer. And then I'm like,
what?
This is a true story.
What's going like, oh, I'm sorry. He's like, yeah, I just can't. You just don't know who you can trust nowadays.
The fishmonger at Ralph's.
And I was like, sir,
someone to talk to.
I just want salmon. So
how does this play into you being intimidating?
Like you were too open of a person.
No,
he
yes,
felt he could talk to you.
He just looked at me.
People think they can open up to you. I've experienced that before where people, like strangers, there's sometimes a quality someone has where people, I don't know what it is. It's like this totally intangible thing, but where people instantly are like, I can tell you stuff. And
sure,
like,
but I'm considering intimidation as something that you are willfully trying to do, not as just a natural passive quality.
Like,
nah,
he's
so,
just not naturally intimidating.
Yeah, you might not be naturally intimidating, but Mike, I bet you could be intimidating if
you
wanted
could turn
to.
It on.
If you were rolling for it, I bet you could be intimidating.
Mm.
Maybe. Maybe not. You're so cuddly.
See, that's what I mean. Yeah. That's exactly.
But I know you. If someone didn't know you, you got a deep voice, dude. You could be like, yo, what are you trying to do? If you yelled, I bet
you yell.
Mike doesn't yell often, but I feel like I've maybe heard it once or twice, and it's fucking scary.
Yeah. If I don't want to get mad. You wouldn't like me when I'm mad. I don't even know what I would do. So, yeah, true. All right, fine.
I tell him all the time to get mad. I tell him, Mike, I want to be kind of scared of you.
I feel like you want to save your husband.
Yeah,
to James's point, I feel like it would happen easy. It could be like a ooh, and part of it is because it's unexpected.
Yeah, it's thrilling. Can you imagine?
I know.
Mike's
our husbands
Mike's
are not very scary, Beth.
I could be scary.
Get fucked, James. Get roped in with me.
Wait, what, Beth?
I'm more afraid of Janice.
Why?
I don't know you as well.
That's yeah.
As my husband.
That's fair.
Am I scared of the grass? James,
I have felt like I've disappointed James, and that's worse.
Oh, that is worse.
About not drinking anymore at New Year's party five years ago?
That does come. That is the first thing that comes to mind.
I forgave you for it. It was five years to the day that I forgave you for it.
I did lie to James's face.
I held on to it for 5 years.
Yep. I will never forget that.
Said he was drinking water, and then I took the cup out of his hand, and it was not water.
Oh,
dang.
I was also very drunk at the time. So in fairness,
fair.
Nonetheless,
roles to always succeed or fail.
What does it mean that I'm like more I'm more interested in picking one that always fails than succeeds?
Because that is the more fun option.
Yeah,
it is. Like character wise, Marjorie's really bad at not investigation, but perception roles. And so just the ongoing bit of I always try to roll for perception and I always see that there's a floor under my feet could be funny. But is it interesting?
Yeah. I think perception is what I would pick to always succeed, because sometimes you just want to know what you're looking at.
I mean,
it's true.
I would probably pick the the wild magic rolls to always fail.
I was thinking that.
My fingers are always crossed impossible when it happens.
To play. Then I never use magic. Are you happy?
Oh my god. That would probably be the one that would wreak the most chaos. Or like any charisma rolls could be fun either way. But yeah.
I'm boring. I really do like the random up and down of if something is gonna succeed or fail, except for when I'm trying to hit a guy. So my choice is I always roll a 20 to hit.
That is, yeah. I mean, it is harder to craft moments where combat rolls are like, I mean, they have to be like do or die, like, you know, moments that those don't come around as often in just like regular combat encounters. But yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that wild magic would be super fun to fail. Obviously, combat to succeed. Charisma rolls, I think, would be fun either way. Like, you're either the most, you can always persuade people or you can't persuade shit. Like Mike was saying, like, you can't intimidate shit. Like, if you always were trying to, like, puff out your chest and everyone's like, aw, little guy. Thank you, Lindsay. Lindsay also asked, are there any items or abilities that you wish you would use more? Kind of talked about this a little bit last time with like some of your favorite items.
Yeah.
But is there like abilities that you guys wish to that you used more?
All
you
that stupid stuff that you get when you're a magic user that I forget exists, such as twin spell or I can't even remember the other ones.
All the shit I forget. Yeah. It kind of made it easier for me when I died and took away everything I had on me.
Yeah.
Like I'm a magic. I'm so sorry. I'm a magic user in Baldur's Gate. And, but the thing is like, it'll automatically do. So if I'm like, oh, a twin spell, it does all that shit for me. And it keeps track of all of my spells.
Sorcery
you know,
points
it's like,
and,
yeah. So I think that's the stuff that I would like to try to use more often. I'm sure people are always screaming at me to use them.
It has gotten easier with the D&D Beyond, I think. That, you know, at least you know, there's like
that does help
buttons to check for spell slots and shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, what's a spell that I wish I would use more often? Like a specific spell is I have one that like imbues. The thing is I have to think ahead to use this, which is a problem because I don't. It's like imbuing one of you guys with like the power of I think it's like eagle or bear.
There's enhanced ability.
Yeah, where it basically gives you like a little extra oomph.
But
to your
early on, didn't you give power of a bear to someone to carry someone back to town or
something? Yeah. Like that, but I never use it. And I don't even know if it's worth, if we're past it now, like if it's kind of at this point, the stuff that we're doing, it like wouldn't even make that much of a difference. But I don't
know. Well, I got into a much better habit of using Bardic Inspiration after Beth always yelled at me about it. So. yell, but, you know, made me feel bad with judgmental sides. And then I got better at it.
And that's friendship.
Thank you, Beth.
Buffs are definitely, I think buffs would be in that category. Because I think you're right, just like the nature of the show is how in the moment I think we are. So there isn't a lot of like, all right, we're preparing for this obvious fighting situation. Let's buff everything. And that kind of goes to what we were talking about a little bit last time about like it, playing a home game versus the show with like exploring rooms and looking for treasure and stuff. Like that's kind of a little bit, it can be shoe leathery if it's not situational specific where like, all right, we're going to everybody cast your buffs, everybody do your, prep for the fight. So that some of that can be a little bit just the nature of the way that the show is. But situationally, I think there could still be opportunities for buffs as we're going forward, because, you know, like a +4 or like Bardic Inspiration, like you were saying, James, like you get an extra dice roll, that can be the difference between, you know, success and failure in a big moment. So that's definitely something to keep in the back of your head.
I regret having never really utilized in a story satisfying way the Spear of Teenage Rebellion that I have.
Oh yeah.
Seasons ago, Margarine like Season was three, like, I don't want to be old, I want to be young. And so I bought this Britannia spear. It's a pink gold spear created by the goddess of teenage rebellion. Cause I thought it would come, I would be able to like use it or whatever. And you can't use it unless you're young. There's a weird element of it. So it's, it can only be wielded by those between the ages of 13 and 19. And
how does that work if I'm an elf?
It would work. Yeah, it would
do
be
you
like
adjust
mentally.
For inflation?
Yeah.
Like how does that
Yeah, so I bitterly bought that, not being able to use it, hoping that at some point I could kind of fold that into the story, and I never did, and it remains a Schrodinger's spear on the wall. No, not Schrodinger. What's the gun?
Chekhov.
A Chekhov spear on the wall. And I don't think I'll ever,
Well, I hope that, James, your girlfriend?
Carebert.
I hope Carebert didn't find it and accidentally use it on herself. And now she's.
Carebert's not a teenager.
Yeah, Carebert's an adult woman.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a stick to her.
Well, good.
I want to use that then. I want to like have another.
Well, I would love to just be at the house and I walk past your bedroom door and you're just fucking around with my spear.
Yeah, I'm like, Star Wars kid.
It's got acid damage.
It's like in Napoleon Dynamite when Kip walks past Napoleon's room and he's like learning how to dance to a tape. That'll be me with the spear. I'm watching like a VHS of like how to do like spear tricks, not even fight, but just how to twirl it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. I always have thought it was funny with that item that it was clearly intended for Zappas and Martrim took it.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's so good. Shane McCarthy asks, how would the bargaining stage of Digerdon have gone if Zappas had kept the mask or if one of the others had been wearing it? Would Martrim still have been the one to go through depression? We touched on what led to the whole Margerdon thing a little bit last time. And I do think that Margerdon still would have been the one to go through depression, even though if Margerdon hadn't have been wearing the mask, Beth and I probably wouldn't have had that conversation that led to that realization. And Beth wouldn't have been Margerdon. We wouldn't have had that kind of dynamic. I would have been playing, you know, the whole thing. But I do think that it still would have eventually got there. I don't think if Zappas had still been wearing the mask, I don't think it would have played out the same way, where it's not that Zappas would have been like Zabaddon.
That's a good name.
It is a good name, though.
Zabaddon. Brand name.
Yeah.
Like Mastodon.
That's when Zabaddon. I fully ascend into being a demon.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Too much power.
It would be like the natural progression of the outfit.
Yeah.
Zappas actually becomes a dragon.
Through Zappas, he would have wielded a power too terrible to imagine, or whatever the line is from Lord of the Rings.
The wild magic as possessed by the god of death.
Right. Character-wise, you know, Zappas doesn't have the same kind of like connection to the dragons that Margarine does. It would have been, you know, we might have gone in a different direction. Probably risk and reward might have been bigger factors. We might have gone more that way and away from the full dragoniness of it. But I do think that as far as like the stages of death, the stages of grief that we were dealing with, Margarine was depression. That just felt the most appropriate for the character. And I want to believe that I would have gotten to that realization on my own as well, although it was much more fun to do it with Beth. So thank you, Shane for that question. Amelia Fowler asked, is the group ever going to go to the Shadowfell? We briefly dipped into the Shadowfell in season 4 in the elevator episode.
Or it was more of an inclined plane.
Yes, inclined plane. Yeah. But will we going forward? Very likely. I'm, you know, no spoilers, nothing set in stone, obviously. But given the given where the story is at, I feel like that is part of the story, and there will be a segment of it that will take place in this different world. That is being established and filled out, fleshed out in the Tim stories. So if you want to hear more about what my version of the Shadowfell is, you can go and check those out for some more shade on that world. It's not good, and it's not good for humans.
It was really scary when we went there. Yeah.
Good thing none of us are.
Oh yeah, I guess that's true. But yeah. Tim is. All right, John Smith asks, my question is for season 5 is how did no one know that Cedric was the professor? I figured it out when Dormax said that the drunk dwarf was Cedric's BFF and because of the flask description. At first I was kind of bummed that the season plot twist was that easy, but Didridon caught me off guard. And then,
I didn't know. I didn't know. And then when it was revealed, I was like, it felt so obvious when it was revealed too. And I thought, I really felt dumb. I felt dumb.
The thing I think people forget is how long it is between recording sessions.
Yes.
So if you're listening to each episode, like as they come out or back to back, you're retaining so much more stuff than we do.
Yeah, because what do we normally record 2 or 3 episodes at once?
At least 2.
Yeah.
We try to do 3. The goal is 3 or 4, and the minimum is 2. So a lot of times it's at least a month in between, just because of, you know, everybody's schedule, you know. And so small details like that, which are, you know, I put those details in more for you, the listener, than for you, the player, because of that reason. You know, those are small details that I have included so that the listener can clock them and go, oh, that's this thing that I just recently heard. But for you guys, the players, it's there if you pick up on it, but it's not essential necessarily. Man, that you do.
I had a magnifying glass up to the conversation between the brother and sister, Cedric and
Elspeth.
Elspeth. And that felt so genuinely like both of us want good in different ways that I kind of clocked them as like, cool, they're just, that's them. And there's no more secrets beyond that. And fuck, I was wrong. What was on the flask?
It was like to my trusted advisor, the professor, or something like that. Okay. And so it was like, oh, he has a flask from the professor. And then the second piece of information was that, oh, he's buds with Cedric. So if you put those two things together, that it's like, oh, you know, they're the same person.
Gotcha. Hold on 1 second. Janice just smelled his hand and made a real face of, oh, my hand smells like ass.
I moved the Leatherface mask because the focus kept auto-focusing on it. And then apparently that mask smells horrendous.
Oh, no. Don't touch it again.
Don't touch it.
Oh, ew. Don't kiss it. Oh, don't use your tongue.
Oh, you put it up to his face.
It's real bad.
Gross.
God, when you make a repulsed face, not for the camera, you know it's bad.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So those details are there more for the audience than for you guys. They do exist as, you know, pieces of a puzzle that if you were to figure out, great. But you know, we don't necessarily have like a great detective type character.
He tried to get me to be one.
I think it's better that you're not very good, especially because now on the Tim side of things, like it's like part of Tim's character that like he thinks that Margarine is like Sherlock Holmes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so, so fun.
Like sometimes, in his head,
sometimes she gets it, but most of the time
no
she thinks she gets
heroes.
It. Wow. Oh. Oh, that's so special. I hope when I die, Tim makes me sound cooler than I am.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's there if you guys figure it out, but it's more for the listener. Those are details for, you know, for you, the listener, to go, oh, this is this, and connect those dots so that you do kind of have the, you know, it's intentional that you kind of figure it out ahead of time because, you know, like, I think it's Hitchcock Truffaut in their conversation in that book, Hitchcock talks about how suspense is knowing.
Bomb under the table.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, oh, yes, you have a bomb under the table at a restaurant. Like, yeah, I know exactly that.
And a beautiful buxom blonde, yes, sitting at it.
Oh, my God.
The suspense is wondering if she would go on a date with her dutiful director.
That's probably what actually was said, yes.
Yeah.
Gross. Oh, yeah. And then John also asked, what do you use to make online maps? Do you have any other way to flesh out the world? We don't use maps. That's what we use. We don't use maps. We don't use maps. We don't use board. Very, very early. Like, I think the first session and only the first session, we tried to use like a play mat.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We did.
Yeah, grid system, and it slowed everything down too much to move pieces around and set them up and everything, and it was too cumbersome with the microphones and everything. So originally we abandoned that for practical reasons, but then I think it became a real benefit to keeping everything theater of the mind because it allowed for flexibility, you know, I could move rooms around in a space because you guys don't have a physical representation of where they go. You can't go, oh, that's not over there because the map says that it's here.
So you could cheat.
Yes. extreme amounts of cheating. You know, that doesn't always work for everybody's game. You know, like, you know, a lot of players need to be able to see where things are to understand and have a sense of space and things. And it is difficult to kind of keep track of the action with full theater of the mind. You listen to the show, you've heard many times I have to kind of backtrack and explain this is where everybody is.
Yeah. I have a hard time with that.
Yeah. And it is, you know, it would be great if we had, you know, more physical representations of where things were. It would be awesome if we had like full miniatures and stuff like that, but that's a time and a budget thing. And a producibility of the show thing, you know, from the beginning. To answer your question, I don't do maps. I have very, very, very rough sketches for my own use, but that's basically just to have a sense of like just making sure that things make some kind of sense physically.
Did we ever talk?
As much as like there isn't an M.C. Escher, you know, space, but
did we ever talk on microphone about when everybody was exploring the castle and there were the wind tunnel room and the tubes of dragon's room and everybody wanted to open a door at the same time. And you
I
just
don't
made
think we've
all
talked
that...
explicitly about that.
Russell made all that up.
Yes.
Like on the spot. And yes. We were like, oh my God, that's crazy. The things that we predicted were going to be behind those doors were. Little do we know, Russell's back there like, yes, they're writing the story for me.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I don't have maps, because there are a few instances like that where you guys will just kind of bullshit something and then I'm just over there like, well, that's funny.
Yeah, you gave us a sound effect and from there,
yeah,
we created a world.
And that possibility is great. And one of the things that I really love about this style of, you know, not having maps, but, you know, it's what's right for your table and for your players. You know, there are definitely players that like without a map or without a physical, you know, play space, like just could not wrap their head around things, which is totally fine.
I think it's worth trying both ways too, because yeah. I, as a player, I found out that I prefer playing this way with the right people. And I have also played with maps. And what I see when I'm playing maps, it totally changes the way that I play, because I'm so fixated on like how many little squares I can move and how mm-hmm. many doors I can see on the little digital screen of where you can go. And the proximity that I am to everywhere, it limits my options, which can be like a safety net and safe and sweet and nice for some people. And me in some contexts. But then also the playing with your friends and having a good time the way that we do on D&D. I know that if I do something wild, someone will be like, ah, that's an impossibility. And then I'll just pivot. But it is more fun to invent possibility.
To that end, and kind of what you were talking about before, Beth, the next part of John's question is I'm making a frog themed dungeon, and one of the hallways is going to flood with frogs the closer they move to the end.
Can I be a character? Can I be a pelican in your campaign?
I'm having
trouble. Open my mouth, go down the tube. Sorry, I'm done.
No. This is good. I'm having trouble coming up with multiple ways the characters can beat this. Can you help me, please?
Put pelicans in the room.
Yes. That is very, very funny if the characters somehow can trigger a bunch of like pelicans that can come and scoop them up and save them from the frog. Beth is very, very tickled.
Have frog rain be a thing.
What do you mean
that's
frog
gonna
rain?
That's going to make more frogs. Yeah,
frog rain. It rains frogs. It happens rains. And don't starve together.
More frogs.
During spring, it'll rain frogs. It sucks.
You can get to
like, I forget what states. I think it's like in the South where like, it's like cane toad. There's like cane toads that are like the super invasive species. And like people who live where these toads are incentivized to kill them. Like you are supposed to, if you see them, you kill them. And then there's places where like, because they're such an invasive species, the like kind of limits on what you can do with them are funky. Like there's, you can like go to bars and there's toad racing and like all kinds of stuff like that. So I don't know, make a weird toad economy.
That's a great idea. So the problem that we're trying to solve is, hey, I've put a ton of frogs in this hallway. How do I give these people license to get rid of the frogs?
Yes. And my suggestion would be have a solution, have one planned. There is a hidden button that if they roll a perception check that beats this number, they will find and they'll see the button and they'll press it and that'll open a passage or whatever. Have a solution so that there is one.
It'll flush the frogs.
Gas the frogs, whatever the solution is. But like what Beth was talking about earlier, where, you know, they kind of created those rooms in the underground cult temple, or no, it wasn't the temple. It was the secret lair. It was the mountain lair. Be open to a creative solution that your players come up with, just being the answer, and just go with it. And in the moment, if they're like, is this it? And if it's good and you like it, be like, yep. And then move on. And don't get stuck on the correct solution. Find the one that's fun for the situation and fun for the players and fun for the story. Because if you have like the correct way of solving the problem and the players are beating their heads against the wall trying to find the thing, but they can't because of roles or whatever, that's not going to be fun. That's going to slow things down.
And you're also going to train your players to feel like every challenge they come up against, they have to find the correct thing. And you don't want to be their dad. You want to be their friend.
Like what Mike was talking about last time about gifts, giving gifts to, you know, your scene partners. If you're, you know, and that was specifically talking about improvising, but in this instance, gift something to your players. If your players come up with something, some fun solution to the frog tunnel, then that's the solution to the frog tunnel. You know, like that happened in season 3 in the volcano. everybody had to get through the 9 puzzles to get to the volcano lair, those were elaborate puzzles. And several of them were solutions that I did not write. They were just fun in the moment solutions that the players came up with. And I think we talked about that in that discussion as well. So maybe go back and check that out. But yes, be flexible with your puzzle solutions, because sometimes what the players come up with will make sense logically and be more fun than anything that you had, you know, previously planned out. So, you know, let your players and also then the players feel great because they won and they figured it out. And then everybody goes into the next encounter energized, you know, like, yes, you did it. Yay. And then everybody's feeling good going into whatever the next part of the dungeon is, or the next, you know, the next frog, when then they have to race the invasive frog species in the next room, you know, then
they'll be glad they put 1,000 frogs in their bags of holding.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's one way to do it, is to not have a solution and let your players do it. Okay. So this is from Megan Medina. This is a question that I thought about after thinking about Didredon and how he represents death. Apologies if this doesn't make complete sense. Question. Do the Didredon the team meets in the memory... Does the Didredon team the team meets in the memory cave and the Didredon the team ends up fighting represent two sides of how people view death or being over death? More or less, yes. The idea, even before the, like, stages of grief thing came into it, was that, like, there wasn't going to be one version of this dragon, because there's not one version of what this is. You know, that was something I was really struggling with this season, was like how to represent this concept in a way that hasn't been done a million times. That wasn't just the Grim Reaper. That wasn't just the, you know, Ghost of Christmas Future, or like the Discworld death or Family Guy's death or any other, you know, version of, you know, what we've seen. So I always wanted there to be kind of this fluidity and ambiguity to what this dragon was going to be, compared to like the strong characterizations that we've seen with the other ones. You know, Madeiris was very specific. Kerflippia was very specific, you know, and I wanted Didredon to be not that. I also had kind of set up in the lore and the way that the other characters and stuff were talking about him, even back in season 3 when you guys found the like books in the temple talking about some lore stuff, you know, he was talked about as like Didredon the Dread and this like big, huge, imposing, you know, thing up in the mountains in the cold, and I wanted the encounter when you guys actually got there to be not that. Kind of to subvert those expectations, but also just to show that, you know, there is not one way of doing this. And that was intentional. Long story short, I wanted there to be a fluidity there. And I think we achieved that. And especially once the stages of grief thing came into place, I felt like that really kind of like brought it all together.
Yeah, I agree. As Marjorie, I was having a hard time with the characterization because I wanted to believe that like all the dragons are like the dragons we have met before, which isn't true. But Marjorie wants to believe that. And the fact that Didredon was like sometimes nice and sometimes mean was really hard for, I think, both her and me.
It was hard for, I feel like, everybody, because we didn't know what to believe.
You
know,
yeah, how do you fight this thing that you can't pin down?
Yeah. He kept escaping us.
And I think that's really cool. Once it clicked, once I understood like why that was.
Dellen Miller asks, how did it feel as players in DM going into the season having already discussed the plot line in the previous D&D? That is an interesting question that I'm curious about the answer to from you guys, because we did say explicitly going into this season, this is what we are doing. Which we haven't in the past. So you guys had a sense of like, cause you did have the encounter in season 4 with Durgi. So you kind of knew, okay, there were going to be dwarves. We were going to do this thing. It ended up being different, you know, which we talked about a little bit last time, or the reasons why. I mean, if you can remember, it was like a year ago, but if you can remember what your thoughts were, kind of having an idea of what was going to happen going into it, were you prepared differently, I guess, is my question to you guys, or were you kind of like, was there any part of you that was like, okay, did it feel less like starting a new season and more like continuing from where we left off? Or was it still like starting fresh? This was a long time ago. So acknowledging that it was like a year ago, but
I think it helped set expectations.
Yeah.
I think
you knew there were going to be dwarves and stuff. You knew that it was going to be snowy and deadly.
I think it always feels like picking up where we left off.
It is hard for me to parse the seasons, to be honest.
Well, I guess that's good in a way that they all feel kind of, you know, there's a continuity.
This one's the snowy one. So, you know, going into that, after living in LA for 13 years, we don't get snow. So I don't know last season compared to this season. But I know that, yeah, like I was excited for the wintry cold.
Yeah.
This environment.
The James Bond sequence I ended up really enjoying, like imagining the snow chase and that ended up being fun.
That was fun.
And it was not underground, which was nice.
Yep. Yeah.
Try to keep things above ground.
It was a lot to play with, like, you know, with the snowmobiles and all that stuff. That was a good one.
Jet Weaver asks, what was the biggest change you had to make to this season because of the team's improv? Pants. Was not ready for pants. Bucket Baby and Pants, the whole we're going to make Margarine and Flack this, you know, Vincent adult man of a monster. That was not one I was expecting. Just Beth's choice to try to stay hidden and then James committing to being this like creature. And then I had a lot of fun playing Cedric, like hating the creature.
That was very fun.
You made me hate you so fucking much.
Which was also really fun. To piss off James was pretty fun too. It was a good time to play that kind of just like asshole.
Do you have an archetype of characters that you like to play? That you that you enjoy play. Like if you, since you are the DM, you have to invent all of these side characters. Mm-hmm. And you just said that you really enjoyed being an asshole. Is it special when you get to play an asshole?
It's easier. It's so much easier to just be, be contrarian to what you guys want.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to be, cause like, especially like Cedric, because Cedric's not Yanathan or Morgan or, you know, like one of like the big villains. So he could be kind of just a jackass and not, he doesn't need to have like the big impassioned dramatic speech. He can just be like a xenophobic shit heel, you know, like, and not, I don't have to worry about like making him more interesting than that. So that makes it kind of simpler. But like the things that I fall back on, I guess, are like, you know, because a lot of it is like I don't have a deep bench for character voices. So, you know, I'll fall back to like the goon henchman is an easy one, you know, and like I also think that like Surfer Bro is really easy to do. And like, you know, a kind of just like go with the flow guy is, you know, you'll see a lot of like those kind of characters if you go back through too, of like the, like, you know, supporting player who's just kind of like there to be helpful or whatever. Kind
You're
of go
have
with
a
flow.
Good time.
So, exactly. So those are kind of the ones that I fall back on. But yeah, it's, you know, I'm going to try to have some clearer characters for season six in these different places that we're going to. You know, we set up, you know, a lot of new places and I want to move through them you know, relatively quickly. So we're going to have a little bit more structure to things and stuff, which I think I've said every year, but I guess is technically true. There has been more structure to each season than there was previously. This one a little bit weird because of how weird scheduling was this year, but just in general, it has been truer that each season has been more structured than the last. And, yep. And you know, so we'll have some new characters and some new character types and stuff going forward that I'm excited about as you guys explore some of the places that you got hints at the end of season 5 in your little map room vision. We'll see. I don't even remember what that question was, but I hope we answered it. Here is a question from Nicholas Dokulil. Dokulil?
Oh, I like this one.
Sorry if I'm saying your names wrong. Love the show, and after 2 years, have finally gotten a group of my own going. I always love when people say that they got into the show because D&D because of the show. I think that's so awesome.
Yeah, for somebody who's never, well, I don't know if they've ever listened or played before, but that's really cool.
It's so cool. After learning about more of the species that you've all encountered, Owlin, Kenku, Tabaxi, etc., would anyone choose one of the less human-like species for their next character? And will we see my favorite species, the Loxodon? Loxodons are elephant people.
Whoa.
Yes.
Like in that Mario game?
Mario Wonder? I like the little hippopotamus people. I have a little figure of one on my desk.
Oh, yeah.
That I like, bought at a convention because I thought it was cute.
I like Tabaxi. Cat people.
Little cats. I could see you playing a cat. I feel like you would get into the characterization of that in a fun way.
I don't know who I'd be. Yeah, I'd have to. I'm trying to rack my brain.
It's a shock that I haven't played a Kenku in a campaign yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bird girl. Everybody knows Beth loves birds. And I've been a frog, I've been a human, I've been a halfling. I gotta be a bird. Next one.
Yeah.
Next campaign.
Oh, were you a frog?
Weird little bird guy does seem very appropriate.
I did a Twitch campaign. I played a frog wizard named Hamb. And he was so brave and everyone liked him.
I think that if we had started the show a little bit later than we did, there probably would have been a higher possibility for some of the non-human-y ones. But we started pretty quick after 5e came out. So there a lot of the supplemental materials hadn't been released yet. And we still we even Swashbuckler for Margarine was like still
brand new
test material. It wasn't like the official final version. I think that it probably would have been more likely if we had started a little bit later that some of those would have maybe found their way in, because there would have been like official materials out with those stat blocks and stuff.
Yeah, I really want to play a Humblewood campaign.
What is Humblewood?
Humblewood is a 5e extension that's got just like a little, it's just birds, stall birds.
That sounds cool.
It's great. It's just critters. Yeah, the owl's like a burrow owl. It's a little soldier. They've got like a wizard or a necromancer, Corvum. So it's a raven necromancer. There's like a fancy pigeon wizard. I'm just looking at the art for it, but it's just forest critters as your favorite kinds of D&D classes. Think Redwall, but D&D.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, this looks like Everdell, James.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, this is neat. Cool. But yeah, stuff like that was still pretty new when we started. So that's the short version of why everybody is like one of the basics. Also, though, I think at the time I kind of guided everybody to be like, hey, you know, like you guys aren't the most experienced or for Mike, you know, we're brand new. Mm-hmm. So like maybe take a look at some of the more standard stuff to see if, you know, we can ease into it, and not expecting to still be doing this with the same characters for 6 years. Will there be Loxodons? Yeah. at some point. I mean, how can I turn down the opportunity to put in a elephant man? Like a fancy one with like a pocket watch is the image that's springing to mind, and he's very late and put off by it. This is a DMing question, but I'm going to kind of turn it back on you guys. Brandon Grucock asks, how do you ensure that you aren't copying from other sources? He's asking specifically about DMing and homebrewing and stuff like that. But I'm curious for you guys as players and influences and stuff. I know you know, everybody's pulling from a lot of different sources for inspiration and everything. But you know, you guys have crafted these characters that have become very unique and everything. And I know that you're pulling from influences for them. But what do you guys think as far as, like, how do you use in being inspired by something and kind of put your own spin on it?
That's a big, complicated question.
It is a big, complicated question. Yeah. You know, we don't have to necessarily, you know, solve.
No, of course. Problem, but thinking about it, everything we do is inspired by something and a combination of a lot of things.
Of course.
And how this campaign feels in your head is going to look like the stuff that you've seen before. It's going to look like, what were the ones that you called out? Lord of the Rings.
And that's the one. Yeah, that's the one.
D&D in general is like, it's just
very
like, yeah, the base game is Lord of the Rings. So,
but there's a magic that happens when you actually make the thing. It's going to start, the first couple paragraphs of your campaign are going to feel derivative, and then someone's going to say some bullshit and you're going to say yes to that, and you're going to fold that into the dough, and somebody else is going to add to it, and you're going to fold that into the dough, and suddenly everybody's inspirations, everybody's collective, where they're coming from, adding to the soup pot, makes it something unique, as long as you are allowing it to effectively like blend and influence what you're making instead of trying to fit it into the mold of what you've seen before. Because I find that all the time when I'm like making art and drawing, because there's artists and work that I love that I like. James Jean, for instance, is one of my favorite illustrators, and he recently did a Johnny Walker dragon illustration, or a dragon illustration for Year of the Dragon, that's on Johnny Walker whiskey. And I love that piece. I've been wanting to do a dragon. And I was looking at that piece. I did a couple different sketches. And finally, I landed on a sketch of a dragon that is facing forward the way that James Jean's dragon is facing forward. And from there, I kept drawing. And because I was adding to it and I was actually making it, it became something different than what was in my head. Because it can't help but be something different than what is in your head. And that's what's going to happen with your campaign. So don't feel ashamed for coming to something with influences. Be aware that you don't want to be copying these things, and then let everything around you add color and flavor to what you're making.
Yeah, that's beautifully stated.
Yeah, that's about it.
I'm just going to
copy that and
change a few words. I think for like, in terms of items or abilities and stuff, like for the is it the Cape of Staying Alive?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to use that in a situation in the game, my brain goes to, there's an item in Dota 2 called the Force Staff, and that pushes you in the direction that you're facing, which is exactly what the properties of the Cape of Staying Alive is. But I'm doing a dance. So like, I think of things that I've seen or games I've played, like Gust of Wind in X-Men Legends for PlayStation 2. Storm has her wind ability, and it breaks open all the boxes, and you can get all the XP and stuff. And it's like a really quick way to do stuff. And I like, that's what I think about when I use Gust of Wind in the campaign. So I do that with items, and I think of it as a video game, or, you know, referencing stuff we've seen in media. Yeah.
Yeah, we all, you know, bring our own touchstones to things, especially for this kind of you know, this kind of show that exists in your imagination. You know, what you imagine the show to look like is going to be different than what everybody else does, what I do, what Mike does, what Beth does. You know, my style in the way that I envision the show is going to look different than, you know, Beth or Mike's or anybody's, because my touchstones are different, and the things that I'm inspired by are different. Some of them are the same and some of them are different, and you know, that filter, my filter, is going to be unique to me, and the way that it comes out, like what Beth was saying, by the time it's done is going to be something else. And I think that that's a really important aspect is, you know, and this Sin Sanguis also asked about inspiration storytelling and pushing past writer's block and stuff. And I think that it's just important to keep going and keep, you know, keep trying. If it's something that you're passionate about and you feel like you have a story to tell, whether it's, you know, a story that you want to create for commercial reasons, or if it's something that you're doing as a homebrew game for your friends or whatever, or if you're creating anything, you know, it's, you're going to get to that point where you want to make it your own. That's just a natural part of the creative process. And when you get there and you keep pushing through it, that's when stuff really, really gets special. And, you know, I love those moments when you make something and you step back at it and you look and you go like, oh, this one's good. You know, like that, it's rare, but when it happens, you know, it's really special.
Yeah, trust that your instincts are right. Trust yes. that your choices are okay and good, because you're going to want to say, I've seen this done before and I like what I've seen, and this doesn't look like what I've seen, and therefore it's not right. But it is. Mm-hmm. Something that I was told by, it's too bad I can't remember the mentor who told me this, but it made a real impact. There are so many things that people want that haven't been created yet. Just make stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, you're the first audience. You know, we've said that a bunch, you know, in different versions of these type of episodes, but like, you're the first audience. And if it entertains you, then it's probably going to entertain somebody else. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions and notes of thanks and things. We really, really appreciate it. Okay, I think we're getting close to an hour and a half, or a little over an hour here. So I think we will wrap up this discussion for now. But we will continue the show, obviously. Like I said, next week is going to be a Tim story, TBD for the 31st, and then we'll figure out the February schedule from there. So stay tuned for announcements on that. And then there are a couple other things that are coming. We have the new t-shirt design from Beth.
Yes.
Which is a Johnny Walker inspired design.
Didridon Forge Fire Whiskey.
It's so fun little fancy dwarf lad, and a whiskey logo, which is really, really fun. So patrons, you will be getting those very shortly in the next couple weeks. And then we'll have more t-shirt designs coming on the heels of that one. Yeah. Any con appearances coming up, guys,
that
you guys are aware of?
Next one, for me, if there's anybody in Wisconsin, I'm going to be at Anime Wisconsin, or Anime Milwaukee, AMKEY, March 8th through the 10th. It's my first time in that part of the country, so if you're out there and you want to come say hi, I think it's just going to be me. But we'll see if Mike will come with me. But yeah, that's my next appearance.
What weekend in March?
The 8th through the 10th. So the second weekend.
We are going to be at Horror Hound in Cincinnati, March 22nd, 4th.
Yeah, we got a bunch of conventions this year.
After Horror Hound, we have two back-to-back. We have Astronomicon in Livonia, Michigan, and Spookala in Tampa, Florida. Those are in April.
Cool. So, yeah, so some convention appearances for folks coming up in March and April. So stay tuned. We'll plug those, you know, obviously when they get closer as well, we'll remind you guys. So more info on that soon. I think that's it. Yeah. Next week, the 24th, will be a Tim story. We'll see what's going on the 31st, and then we will go from there. So I think that's all. Thanks again, everybody who submitted questions. Thanks again, everybody who said thank you. All the Spotify raps and everything. So fun. And yeah, I think that's it for me.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, everyone.
This is you.
This has been the best.
Yeah, it really has. Thanks, everybody. Do what's fun.
Do what's fun.
Do what's fun. We'll see you later.
D&D is a Moorpark Media podcast and a Spotify preferred partner. Written and edited by me, James Gressel. D&D is performed by James A. Janisse, Chelsea Rebecca, Beth Bradloff, and Mike Seigen.